Kelly. Mr. Hanna?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ron Hanna. I represent the appellant in this case, Paul Kelly. Today I'll be discussing the issue of the voluntariness and knowingness of Mr. Kelly.
Were you his counsel at the trial also?
I was not, Your Honor.
Not trial, the
issue
of
why
did his lawyer enter a blind plea for him, or permit him to enter a blind plea after the judge declared the first plea agreement void?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I would suggest it was probably a bad judgment call on the part of his attorney. It seemed like from reading the transcripts that the whole proceeding was rushed after the...
But isn't that the real problem here? Not a mistake by the judge, but somehow a failure of his lawyer to communicate. Both to communicate, just a failure to communicate with his client, whose behavior seems incomprehensible.
Well, I believe that based upon probably a lack of communication from reading these transcripts, the defendant was unaware of a lot of his rights, and I think he was trying to limit his exposure by pleading to this factual stipulation that he had filed pro se at an earlier point in time.
How did he end up pro se and filing a factual stipulation?
From my dealings with this individual, Your Honor, I would suggest that he likes to do a lot of things pro se.
What can we do about this, given the fact, as the government points out, that we don't seem to have a motion anywhere where he's trying to withdraw the second guilty plea? Judge Moran went through a very careful inquiry, even at the blind plea stage, saying you're doing this voluntarily and so on and so on. Isn't that the end of it? I mean, once we've got a plea agreement, even if whatever history's gone on before, all gets folded into it.
Right, Your Honor, but that's in essence the whole substance of the first argument of the brief, that because of this misrepresentation that the judge made to the defendant, that his plea was not knowingly involuntary, so he is therefore, if we vacate the blind plea, then all he hasn't waived his non-jurisdictional defects that occurred prior.
But what are the jurisdictional defects? A failure to give an accurate account of the law isn't a jurisdictional defect. Suppose the judge somehow or another was mistaken, or supposing, I'm expecting a 2255 in this case any minute now from the performance of the first lawyer, but putting that to one side, if he had felt at all hesitant about the second plea agreement, the judge gave him every opportunity to say so, even if he'd been mistaken about the first one. And I think the judge's statement about things that he said being used against him was at least partially true. He had certainly made some statements that would have been usable, and maybe that was enough to make this a rather wise move anyway.
Okay. Well, I would suggest that there were really three things, as the defendant stood there in court that day, that were being held against him that he thought were going to be held against him. First, that the government had a unilateral... could unilaterally determine that the plea agreement had been breached. Second, that all of these statements in the plea agreement, which were extensive, could be used against him in court. And third, that he really never did understand the relevant conduct, the consequences of relevant conduct, and that in the totality of the circumstances, maybe any one of those things individually wouldn't be a cause for saying that this is a not knowing or voluntary plea. But when you take totality of circumstances and all three of these things, and the fact that it was the court and its misinformation, which has been discussed in two prior cases this morning, that there's a fundamental misinformation about the situation, that the defendant is standing there and he's backed into a corner where he thinks that he has nothing.
What's so strange about it, if he thought that he would be harmed by the statements in the plea agreement being used against him. I mean, that makes his unwillingness to take the ride all the more incomprehensible.
And I'm not sure what motivated him to not take that ride that day, Your Honor.
Well, as you say, he is one who seems to want to act on his own without necessarily benefit of counsel. But there's no confusion of the fact that he did not cooperate with regard to the government, is there? I mean, he said they wanted him to go on a ride and he didn't want to go.
I don't think there's any question that he did not cooperate in that regard, but there's a question as to whether that's a substantial breach of the plea agreement.
But the government, to put it mildly, district courts take with huge deference representations from the government about whether a defendant has complied with one of these undertakings to give full and complete cooperation, full and truthful cooperation, whatever the phrase may be in the particular agreement. If the government stands up and says, in our view, we could have gotten enough about this neighborhood or the house or so on if he'd come along that we think that's not cooperation, I can't think of a district court or certainly a court of appeals decision where we've said that the district court would have overridden that representation from the government. Can you? Have you seen any cases where district courts have disagreed with the government's assessment of cooperation?
No, Your Honor, but again, the failure here was that there was no determination that there was a substantial breach in its sentencing.
But Judge Moran implicitly figured that's the end of it. You know, once he's not going to go in the ride, the cooperation has stopped, and he does jump sort of to part two, and therefore he says there's no way the government's going to make the 5K motion, so this is all over with. Now, he's a little bit summary, but I think that's pretty clearly what he was thinking.
Right, but I would note that at sentencing, the district court told Mr. Kelly that, and given him an acceptance of responsibility, downward departure, that a great deal of information he had given to the government, and that because of this failure to take a ride in an automobile out into the country was a fairly minor aspect of his cooperation, and that was him applying the correct standard at sentencing.
Within the context of sentencing, though, within the context of whether he gets the acceptance of responsibility three levels, and also where in the guideline range he wants to go. But I don't think Judge Moran was saying at the same time, and I think the government was wrong, that part of the cooperation that was sought for was this ride.
Okay.
Seems like they're two different things.
Well, I would suggest that under the totality of circumstances, given all these matters and the basis or the fact that he was fundamentally misinformed about the situation, that his plea was not voluntary, and if the court in fact finds that his plea was not voluntary, that the minor matter of not taking a ride in this automobile out into the country to help the government when the defendant had said, I have given them directions on how to get to this person's house. I've told the government which exit to get off of.
Well, that sounds, again, like somebody who wants to take charge and do things his own way, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But the time that he's standing in court, he may be the type of person who likes to take things into his own, take things into control. But he was saying, I fear recrimination. The government, if I'm not able to pinpoint this house, they're going to hold this against me. And then and there, after all this cooperation, say that there's you have not complied with the plea agreement. So I would say that was a fairly minor matter in light of all the other cooperation the defendant had provided to the government within the year and a half between the entering into the negotiated plea agreement and this hearing on March 25th, 2002. So I would ask that the court find his guilty plea was not voluntary, vacated, and remand for resentencing pursuant to the plea agreement. And there's substantial difference here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanna.
Thank you.
Mr. Pope?
May it please the court, counsel. There are, with respect to the defendant...
Why did the government care that much about his taking the ride? He obviously wasn't going to be helpful on that ride. Why don't you just drop it?
As the government informed the district court, if we got to the neighborhood, we certainly could. The marshals who the government counsel informed the district court that there was a marshal involved in the case who was skilled in tracking down fugitives or tracking down individuals. If he got to the neighborhood and the defendant could confirm that, yes, in fact, this is the neighborhood, not necessarily the house, we could then track down that individual.
And well, wait, I don't understand. You know what neighborhood it is?
We do not know what neighborhood it was.
What are you going to drive all around Chicago looking for a neighborhood?
With the defendant's help, yes, Your
Honor. Wait, you're going to drive all... Wait, I'm completely lost. Where are you going to start the drive? Where are you going to start looking? What's the area in which you're going to...
Presumably with the directions that the defendant had already
provided. He knew the neighborhood, but he didn't know the house. Was that it?
Well, he knew the general vicinity. There, my understanding of the record is that there were...
By quadrants or by neighborhoods or what?
That there were other neighborhoods around there. As to which neighborhood it was once you got off that exit was a question that if the defendant were in the car, he could, in fact, assist the government and the agents with saying, this is the neighborhood. And at that point, would be able to then go track down...
What's the neighborhood?
I'm sorry?
What's a neighborhood for these purposes?
That I don't know. I don't know. I have not gone out. I did not go out, and the record does not indicate.
You're talking about suburbs, not the city?
Yes, Your Honor, as I believe. That is my understanding of the record, Your Honor. And
neighborhoods within suburbs? Or is a suburb a neighborhood? You see, what's missing here is... There was no real hearing on whether this was a material breach. The judge from, I don't know if he really thinks this, but the impression from reading the hearing is that the judge thought that he had no power to determine whether it was a material breach or not, that the government had unreviewable discretion not to move for the downward departure. That's wrong, isn't it? I mean, surely there's, as with any contract, you can have a breach that's so minor that it doesn't count as, that it's not actionable.
Yes, Your Honor, and this court in Lazine, the Lazine case, in fact, indicated that.
Right, so where is there any indication that the judge made such a determination?
Your Honor, it would be... One, in Lazine, it was from a de novo review where the defendant had in fact requested a hearing, had in fact argued that the government had breached the plea agreement, asked for specific performance of the plea agreement. We have none of that here. So on appeal, it is of course plain error. And the government would submit that the evidence was clear that the defendant refused on his own to cooperate with the government's
investigation. No, I understand he refused, but the question is whether it's a material breach, and this neighborhood question, I think, is germane to that. I mean, maybe it would have been completely obvious that the ride was not going to be helpful and that the government was just annoyed with this fellow. I suppose, understandably, he seems stubborn, so they decided to whack him. But of course, what's so strange, if instead of entering this crazy blind plea, he had said, well, all right, the agreement is down the drain, so I want a trial. Then the government would quickly renegotiate the plea agreement because you wouldn't want to have a trial of this fellow just to get him, just because he didn't go on a ride.
Well, it went beyond, as we explained in our brief, his failure to cooperate went beyond just the failure to take that ride. That had consequences that the district court well knew, because the government had informed the district court that the government was intending to call the defendant as a witness in at least two other trials involving 13 other
co-conspirators. Yes, but I don't understand your argument that if he'd been called as a witness in these other trials, he would have been impeached by his failure to take a ride. On the contrary, his testimony would be strengthened because it would show that he wasn't just a pliant tool of the government. He was an independent thinker, and he had refused to cooperate fully with the government. That would make his evidence more credible.
Arguably, but at the same time, he would be impeached by the fact that he was selectively deciding who he was going to provide evidence against. That's the point of what we put in our brief.
Precisely, and that says that, you know, what if he took the position, look, I'm not going to help the government frame Debbie or whatever it is. I'm just going to testify in cases where I am convinced that the government has a good case. That seems to me makes him a better witness than someone who says, well, I'll do anything because I, you know, for my punishment discount.
If in fact that was his motive.
But if you presented that to the judge, and if he had realized or articulated some concept of a substantial versus a de minimis breach, the outcome might have been different.
Was this a situation where he did not provide specific address of Debbie?
Yeah,
is that how it started? The government wanted a specific address of this particular individual?
The defendant had indicated that he had been there on numerous occasions.
And he wouldn't provide an address?
5 years earlier.
Five years earlier. He provided directions as to which highway and even which direction he thought they should take, or which exit they should take.
You asked for an address, right?
My understanding is that did occur. That is not in the record.
It's not in the record?
I do not believe that's in the record. I mean, what is in the record is that he had provided information as to the highways to take, which exit to get off, and the government had asked, do you know where Debbie lives?
Well, the first thing in the transcript says, you indicated the other day you wanted to have a hearing possibly on the question of cooperation with regard to this woman. Tell me where this woman, Debbie, lived. And it goes on to say that there was no address, and then he wouldn't give the directions. So there was some indication in the record.
I was mistaken then, Your Honor. Now, going back to Judge Posner's question, this, of course, does not matter. It's clear in the Supreme Court case in Ruiz has made clear the defendant does not need to know complete knowledge of all of the relevant circumstances. And as Judge Wood earlier indicated, that she expects the 2255 any day in this case. The Supreme Court cases have made clear that misunderstandings about the strength of the case, the admissibility of the evidence, or a change in the law is not sufficient to give rise or to call into question the voluntary and knowing nature of a guilty plea. What's needed, and what those Brady, Richardson, and Broth make clear, is that you need to couple that with a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. The defendant has not made that in this case.
It's a separate question whether there was actually a breach of the plea agreement.
Yes, Your Honor, but once the court finds that it is null and void.
Yes, I know, but my concern is that it's only null and void, if you want to call it that, if there was a substantial breach or material breach, and the judge never actually made a determination of that, because he gave the impression from what he said that he thought that it's the government that decides whether the breach is material, not the judge. Which you agree is wrong.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, this is on before this court, it is a plain error review, and it is clear, the Supreme Court cases have made clear, that this does not give rise or does not call into question the voluntary and knowing nature of the defendant's guilty plea. And if, in fact, he was concerned about whether or not he could seek specific performance of that plea agreement, what he should have done is enter a conditional guilty plea under 11A2, and specifically reserved on the record or in writing the right to go forward to contest that issue on appeal. He hasn't done that, and there was no plain error.
So if that were raised in a 2255, we should, what should we do about that?
With a 2255 as to whether or not he received effective assistance of counsel, what takes care of that is in fact the defendant did in fact breach this plea agreement. He breached the plea agreement, and therefore there was no error. The district court properly concluded that the plea agreement was null and void.
It doesn't resolve the 2255 issue if the lawyer didn't give him proper advice, especially about entering into a blind plea.
There is no prejudice to the defendant and no reason to reverse or no reason to upset the conviction and guilty plea.
Well, there would be if he succeeds in his 2255.
But only if, in fact, there was error on behalf of the district court in concluding that the plea agreement was null and void. If there is no error there,
that's
there
not true.
No effect.
That's not true. Even if it was null and void, if the lawyer told him, go ahead and enter a blind plea, that could be ineffective assistance with prejudicial consequences, couldn't it?
Not knowing what the lawyer had counseled him, I can't speak to that. But if the district court did, in fact,
like a terrible proliferation of litigation just because he wouldn't take the ride. But...
And for those reasons and the reasons set forth in our briefs, the government asks that the judgment be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cole.
Thank you.
Mr. Hanna, how much time do we have? 1 minute?
Your Honor, I would argue that this case goes directly to the heart of the fairness and integrity and reputation of judicial proceedings. As you stated in your question initially to the government, why does the government care about this car ride? It seems so insignificant in the grand scheme of things.
Wants to find Debbie.
Right. Well. But the government should not be allowed to strong-arm a person and demand that they stand on their head if the person doesn't want to stand on their head.
Well, it's just taking a ride. In fact, you'd think he'd enjoy the outing, right? Prisoners usually love to be taken out of jail, you know, for a hearing or something. And this would be just a, this would be a ride in the country.
Yes, Your Honor.
Suburbs.
But ultimately, it shouldn't be up to the government to strong-arm a person into making them do something that may not be a substantial breach of the agreement without having the judicial determination that is, in fact, a breach of the plea agreement. So I would suggest that the government in this case should be upheld to their end of the bargain.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Mr. Hanna, you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. And the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.